Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Sean Pepper Podcast. On this podcast, I seek out and speak with growth-minded humans like yourselves. My job here is to connect with experts from a variety of fields and disciplines to explore how we develop ourselves and others in today's dynamic environments. I aim to provide you with digestible and actionable information you can use in your professional and personal life while exploring what it means to be human, at work, at home, and online. If this episode or podcast is meaningful to you, please consider sharing with others or letting me know on Twitter or Instagram at Sean_Pepper. And as always, thank you for listening.
Welcome to Sean's Podcast.
Today on the podcast, we have Dylan Jones. Dylan has 10 years of entrepreneurial experience in startup leadership positions. He was the founding CEO of Terra CO2 Technologies, a mining technology company, as well as the founder and CEO of Coast Protein, Canada's first cricket protein company. Dylan obtained his MBA in the clean energy economy and focuses on products and technologies that either help people or reduce negative impact on the environment. Dylan, can you provide us your journey up until this point as an entrepreneur?
I honestly never thought of myself as an entrepreneur, even though I've always been pretty entrepreneurial. I never put that label on myself. So I've always just pursued things that have been interested in me. And I found for my first company, the tech company, a real need for the mining industry to move towards sustainability. And for along that same track with Coast, definitely move towards sustainability in our food systems. My one kind of benchmark is everything I do tries to have something around sustainability. I'm pretty much always just trying to find or looking for new solutions to old problems and working on how to fix them. And then if the entrepreneurial journey does exist around it, I'll pursue it. But if not, I partner with some of my business partners that I have now or other companies to get those things out there as well.
Awesome. What grew that from you from childhood? Where do you think that itch comes from?
My dad was an entrepreneur. So he was in tech. He started as a carpenter, went back to school in his 30s to do computer engineering and got into the tech game pre the dot-com bubble in 99-2000. So he was in robotics and innovation. So I definitely saw that as a viable lifestyle, viable career from the get-go. My mom was a school teacher who basically funded our family for many years as my dad ground his way up to running a fairly successful robotics company that he sold to Ford. So I'd say that's pretty much it, right?
Of course.
Not much more influence from there.
Yeah, cool. How do you think being raised by a teacher played into the way that you approached business?
Yeah.
Did that change anything? I don't know.
My mom's a pretty unique cat. She's always shirked the traditional kind of motherhood stereotype. So even though she was a school teacher, she was the one who led the way when we went hiking, and we did a lot of backpack camping as kids. Even I remember being 4 or 5 years old, carrying a little backpack, little bottle of water or something like that. My mom was definitely the one who led the way on that. Also, her being a school teacher, I have to credit her in a kind of a backwards way, is she was actually a school teacher in the district that I went to school, both elementary and high school. So you get in trouble and she knows before your homeroom teacher does thing. And it made me really good at being sneaky and figuring out creating the problems. It also gave me the gift of gab, because as soon as I knew I was in trouble from an administrator or a teacher, I always... not always, but typically would figure out a way to talk my way out of them telling my mom.
Nice. You said the outdoors is a big influence. Is that something that's still part of your lifestyle now as you're an entrepreneur? And how do you find a balance between getting outdoors and work?
So I'm a pretty fortunate. We're both on the West Coast. We're both from the West Coast. I live just outside of Vancouver, 5 minutes away from a place called Burnaby Mountain. And so I can walk there every morning. And I do every morning for an hour and a half with my dog. We leave about 6:15 every morning. We go for kind of a run hike on the mountain. It's pretty much up in the wilderness as much as you can be in an urban setting. Pretty much every weekend I'm out in the bush in some capacity, like a lot of guys who chase this kind of entrepreneurial or grind through the entrepreneurial dream or going after nicer cars. I'm going after greasy old Jeeps with, you know, big tires and rooftop tents and big roll bars and stuff like that. That's really my goal. My goal for work is this: more work equals more time outside. I did lose that for a few years when I was so busy with Coast Protein as we scaled and went into international groceries and things like that. I was working so much that I really lost that focus, and unfortunately kind of led me, I think ultimately led me in the wrong direction, which since I've closed Coast, I've really gotten back in a big way and really made my life back again about being outside and doing what I enjoy and letting that bring the creativity I need to be successful in business.
That's awesome. And when you mentioned it led you the wrong way, what advice would you have for somebody that it doesn't necessarily have to be outdoors, but part of their life and they can feel slipping away to not enough time in the day? What advice would you give to that entrepreneur?
There's no such thing as working more long-term and providing value. Just to preface it and add context, there's definitely times when you got to grind through 24 or 48 hours of no sleep and work to get a deadline that's really important. Maybe you get a last minute proposal for a big client. You really got to nail it. By all means, stay up all night, work your ass off, get that shit done. But doing that for months, there's this like real pervasive notion within the entrepreneurial community that grinding is somehow valuable. It's not. You're exhausted, robotic people don't bring creative solutions to real world problems. They don't add value. They don't create money. Like, they just don't. I went through it. I failed because of how exhausted I was, because I thought if I worked my way through my problems, they would be solved. It's not true. You need creativity, you need sleep, you need exercise, you need a healthy balance. Like, it doesn't mean you can work 4 hours a day at the start of a launch of a company, but it does mean when your company is on the right footing, you put it to a cash flow position or positive cash flow position. It means, you know, work 6-8 hours a day, get paid a little bit at the start, and take some breaks. It's something that I learned, unfortunately, the very hardest way. But I feel I do see more of that in the kind of the entrepreneurial literature too, is a lot of people are recognizing that and starting to shift away from it as well.
Yeah, I can definitely see that, wanting to keep going or working really hard or pushing through it just so that you can provide not only that money or that cash flow for yourself, but also for the people that you're providing financial, you're providing a living for.
I think it comes down to, it's your goal, right? My previous two businesses, one was successful, one wasn't. Was to get VC money, was to get that big, get the push hard, get the big valuation, take on investment, get a big valuation, then move to the next big round of money. And it's flawed. It's a flawed way of thinking. Like, people have made a shitload of money doing it, but it's a flawed way of thinking that doesn't create sustainable businesses, doesn't create long-term wealth, it doesn't create happy employees. It creates, I don't know what it creates really in the end. I even look at some of the unicorns that are going through that right now. You know, Uber is not doing so well. Airbnb is on the ropes. Snapchat's never made money. Like, you just look at these things and go, wow, is it really worth it to burn billions, or in, you know, my case, it's burn hundreds of thousands and millions on the chance? And instead, looking at business as a cash flow and saying, I want to be positive cash flow from month three. So I'm going to invest in this business idea, test the market, make sure it's a good idea, validate it, go forward. It is, now we're positive in cash, and we're always going to be positive in cash. And if we see a scale point that we cannot reach be due to lack of revenue or lack of cash, then think about investment. But it's this, that mentality of chasing unicorns, I think, is very damaging to people financially. There's a lot of ruined entrepreneurs down there, but it's also emotionally and health-wise, it is as well.
Yeah, that's a fair point. How does somebody take a business? So you started the business out of your basement. You're making protein bars and cricket bars, and then they started selling them at farmers markets. Can you take us through a little bit of the journey of the cricket business?
Yeah, sure. So we actually never did farmers markets.
Okay.
On purpose. Not that I don't like farmers markets. I am. I'm a West Coast millennial. I love my farmer's markets. I love paying $10 for a bunch of 4 carrots. But no, when you go to farmers markets, you look around and it's living in a bubble. And
sure,
I recognize that immediately. If you have a head on your shoulders, you go to a farmers market, this is a bubble. It's a super fun bubble, like an amusement park, but it's not a place to build a business. So
sure,
I started at I started online, first of all, which is a great, the best place in the world is e-commerce to validate a business quickly.
Yep.
And then I, for brick and mortar, I looked at things like high-end coffee shops, high-end food stores, health and wellness stores, progressive food stores, things like that, that do high turn of highly valuable products.
I'm just going to stop you there and interject here. So how did you go about doing that?
Yeah, we did pretty like standard marketing stuff. Like we created our buyer personas, mapped out our customer journey, but then I'd take bars and I'd walk into the store and or phone beforehand and talk to the manager and pitch them and just do the old burning shoes. I burned a lot of pairs of shoes, pounding pavement, burning rubber, going in, talking to many people, learning about what they were looking for in progressive food, learning what the niches were, all through speaking to customers and to proprietors. And then e-com, we would take those learnings and put them into our ad campaigns, right? Into our marketing and ad campaigns and learn on, I don't know, like the basic stuff, right? Go on Facebook, build an audience, do lookalikes plus fives and really test the shit out of different ideas and see what worked. I can't say we wrote the book on marketing. We used pretty simple stuff and it was really successful.
But it was effective.
Within our niche was very successful.
How did you calculate your expenditure? So there's a lot of people they want to go commerce first and maybe they don't have a food product, but they struggle with how much money do I spend on advertising to get it in front of customers to attract the right audience? What was your CPA? So CPA for those people listening, it means the cost per acquisition. So, and there's also another metric, which is a customer lifetime, which I'm going to ask for in a second, but.
Yeah, we calculate our CPA in two different ways. On e-commerce, we did it the standard way of looking at conversion rates from advertisements. So looking at how many click-throughs we got on ads and engagements before that customer purchase, and that's you use your pixel and figure it out that way. It's pretty simple stuff, especially if you're using a platform like we were with Shopify. With brick and mortar, it's a lot harder. Brick and mortar, if anyone wants to go into the food or beverage industry and have their food and beverage in grocery or any retail, like you're demoing, right? Like you're in store, you're cutting up product or sampling it, you're talking about it for hours on end. And that person might buy $5-6 worth. So your CPA in store is like fucking $80, man. Like it's very expensive. However, when you go to a food or beverage item, there's no better value than a customer tasting your product. Like you can't beat that. But if you're going to move next question, kind of LTV, which is lifetime value, we got better LTV from grocery than we did from e-com. Mm-hmm. But it costs a lot more to get that LTV.
So right. That makes sense. Like you go in e-commerce, you don't feel like you actually know the person. I think it's the personal relationship. I know that guy. I really like him. I liked our interactions. I'm going to buy from him.
Sure. I mean, that was hugely helpful in our launch days. You can replicate that on e-com as well. Good businesses do that with highlighting their customers. They highlight their employees and talk about their employees and like what cool things they're doing. They have founder profiles and do fun Instagram highlights or stories. If you ever see a business on your Instagram feed and they're highlighting their dog or something like that, they're pulling on your heartstrings for a reason. It works really well to build that relationship because you think of the people like, oh, I love their dog. And we did that the same. Like we, at the same time, not that I got my dog for Instagram, but when I got my dog, he was definitely highlighted as Eddie the Coast Shop.
There you go. I think that's actually really meaningful for a lot of people to think about. I know a lot of people through Instagram and stuff, they create businesses and then they don't really give insights into the founders or insights into the people because they're so worried about marketing the branding or the brand image or stuff like that. And you watch this YouTube video and somebody gives away a free Tesla to 10 of them, to their friends. And then they pay that guy to do that. How does that make sense? And that's all based on our ability to then share that story with the virality of those types of stories and that feel good moment and thinking about how that would feel. Well, we can relate to that.
Your modern consumer, you or me, I don't want to speak as a consumer as like this entity, right? We are, with social media and the internet and the pages we all visit, we're hit with advertising constantly. I can't remember the statistic is. It's like 2,500 pieces of advertising a day. The modern consumer is so sophisticated in recognizing bullshit when it comes to marketing, advertising, totally. Branding, etc. That I've always argued this. The modern consumer, if you went back to the Mad Men era, they'd be better than those ad guys that created an ad campaign. Just totally. A regular person who's not, has no involvement in business at all because of how exposed they are. It's just experience.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
You have your companies that are your megas, your huge companies, but then you have your companies that are, you call them your small businesses, your cash flow businesses, your lifestyle businesses, whatever you want to call them, that need to build that niche and that following of loyal customers through trust. The funny thing is, in my now like consulting days, working with a lot of small businesses, a lot of founders or business owners feel like trust goes one way. They're like, I need to make my customers trust me. I'm like, yeah, but you also need to trust your customers to support you. Trust is a two-way street, and you do that through building a relationship. And it's no different than building friends, than building that niche market. And you know, if you expand to something massive, a great example is Gymshark, right? Gymshark's now a billion-pound company, like $1.5 billion company, U.S. dollars. But they built that through building relationships within the fitness community and providing like high-quality products, supporting people doing their own thing, like raising money and such, and continue to do that. And they've become a massive company. So it's from the smallest company to the biggest company nowadays. If you're trying to be different, you have to build that niche.
Yeah, and the customer has to feel like you're their friend. I feel as a consumer, I want to see the journey. I want to see the behind the scenes now as a consumer, which wasn't something that I necessarily wanted to see before. I want the company feel real. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
I feel like because of social media and everybody now being part of a marketing campaign of themselves, people get the bullshit, and as a result, now they want companies to get vulnerable and see the behind the scenes, because we're not getting enough of that, really. We're getting this perfected thing all day long. And we understand, because now we're part of that content creation of marketing ourselves, quote unquote. We want that vulnerability from companies. We want them to feel like our friends, to reach out and say, hey, we're not doing well, or hey, could you help support us by doing X?
Yep, for sure. And that's why now more than ever that customer service is the most important thing, because people just want to know that they've been heard. Like, sometimes it's an impossible fix, but at least you're trying.
Yeah.
And that was one of the reasons we with Coast expanded and scaled so quickly, was we treated who knows, it might have been our downfall eventually, but every customer, we took every customer's issue very seriously and worked on it to fix it. And then spoke like a founder would phone them and try to fix that problem. The referral business was out of this world, man. Like, we lowered our CPA on e-com massively because of that referral business. And in store, we had the stalkers on the aisle, people that would recommend people, hey, what bar should I get? And you get this one because the people are really cool. They come in here all the time and talk about it, and it's really good. And, you know, it tastes really good, but they also like really believe in it. So that was really important for us.
Yeah. We talked about this before we hit record, but like, how do you see mission-driven companies being able to spread their message and still then try to scale? I'm interested to hear your approach, because I know you studied sustainability. I think most people generally want to build businesses that are sustainable and that have these, you know, long-tail practices. I think people are just really short how to make it viable and scale that business.
Oh man, there's a lot in there.
Yeah, sorry.
I think to hit the first one, to when you're talking about scaling, man, scaling is a different beast. Almost anyone who has that entrepreneurial spirit or who believes in a product can make a company like can make a six-figure company. It's not that hard anymore. If you're fairly savvy with digital advertising, not even fairly savvy, like you just watch YouTube videos. There's so much good free content. I learned so much from YouTube. You can make a very good six-figure business, mid six figures. To scale above that, you need either operational gumption, so you need to really dig into and learn, or you need to have experience or skills. Scaling, and this is the thing I talk to like with a lot of entrepreneurs, and as I said, I consult with a lot of small businesses who are moving from $600,000 in revenue to $1 million, $2 million, $3 million sort of thing. That's my niche that I work on. That position you need to put yourself in is you need to go from an owner or from an entrepreneur to a business like runner.
Yeah.
That really is, you know, totally. And I think in the past you could run a brick and mortar store. You could make like $80,000 a year at retail, and it was just you working, and you could make yourself a nice lifestyle for yourself. Now it's impossible. You have to be aggressive. Entrepreneurism is not easier than it ever has been, but it's easier to be excess. It's easier to get into. There's gurus selling you bullshit, and there's millions of YouTubes. Videos on how to do things that like
I'm gonna coach you from my Ferrari on how to do this. It's easy. Yeah, you can just work 3 hours a day and you will become rich too.
And like a lot of those guys, they have basic knowledge and they got above average marketing skills, and people pay them $1,000 for their course. And I've paid for those courses just to see what's going on, to compare against what I teach my clients. And I'm like, oh man, this is trash. I should put a course out for $1,000, and the shit people put out is trash. But there is good stuff, right? There's things like affiliate marketing.
I just recently got into affiliate marketing. That's actually how I'm going to plan on funding this podcast. Not funding it in the way that like I want to make it rich. I just want to pay for new equipment gear and get better mics and those type of things. So when people mention tools or things like that, I'm going to use affiliate marketing. And if they choose to click, then they can choose to click. And if they don't, then that's okay. I'm not upset about it. But
think of that in the terminology of entrepreneurship, like in over the long term. Like imagine telling an entrepreneur, like an old school guy in Midwest America who wanted to make auto parts in the fucking 50s or 60s, that you can create a blog or a website and review stuff that you don't own. And then if you're good enough with SEO and you're good enough with a bit of ads, that then you can put backlinks in those reviews and you pump out, say, a few dozen of them in a few months of like camping gear. And then every time someone clicks and buys on that, you get 5 or 10% commission. You don't ever talk to anyone. You don't ever create a product. And you can make a couple $100,000 a quarter. Honestly, jack shit. Like, that's the competition. So I tell my clients who want to sit still on projects and saying,
hey, buddy.
It's pretty much impossible to sit still in this climate. Eddie, we know you exist. Stop howling at me.
Yeah, no, that's the thing that I think is the hardest part. You're not going to have this closed system that exists anymore. Like, you're not going to be able to protect that for 5 years. You're not going to be able to do things the way that you did for 5 years and just keep doing them that way. It needs our systems, or the way that we think about things, need to have some areas that are closed systems and closed loops that can be automated by technology. And then we need some areas that are open systems to be able to solve these smaller problems and then put them back into that closed loop system. But it isn't the case now that you can just have a business model and not keep reinventing it. It just doesn't exist.
Yeah, exactly. There's a big world and will continue always for proprietary information and technology. But there's also this like kind of middle ground right now where people think, oh, my idea is perfect and it's the only one. There's a million people already doing this. It's just, what value do you offer your niche? It always makes me laugh, right? Because Canadians say niche and Americans say niche. And Americans have that great saying that the niche, the riches is in the niches. Like the riches is in the niches. I guess it's our French background, but it really is. You can offer the exact same service as someone, but if you've niched down and you found your blue ocean within your niche, then you can make a seven-figure business running with a few people just yeah. because you found your position globally, because there's so many people. And yeah. that's something that I focus on a lot right now is if I have a brick and mortar business, which I have one in the general contracting world, I build a very strong local network, but my distribution company that we sell CBD products and other cannabis products through, man, I have contracts in Trinidad, UK, Japan, Eastern Europe, and the US. Like, I look at opportunity. I don't look at one locality.
Of course. You're able to have these globalized connections because of globalization. What would you say to founders when they're negotiating, that they're dealing with getting money coming in? So I think a lot of founders have a real hard time trying to understand, I don't want to give away the bank. I don't understand how to project my company. I want to project a strong position, but I don't know how to make that formula up. What would you say in terms of getting investment when you are at that $600,000 to $3 million range?
First of all, there is no formula.
That's the funniest thing, because I mean, to one person will give you one advice, another person will give you another advice. Somebody will say, you need this metric in order to calculate. And if you go pitch this VC, you need to say this. It's a crapshoot. How can entrepreneurs try to figure that out? You're trying to explain this maybe to your friends, if you're going to do a friend or family round, or, you know, how this all works. Yeah. What was your experience?
Oh man. So there's a lot there again. You're talking to a guy who's the lowest amount of money I've taken for investment in a friends and family round is $2,500. And the most I've ever raised for a large mining project was $12 million. So I've been from the smallest to pretty big. 12 million is pretty big. It's obviously not as big as it gets. There's a lot, it goes a lot higher than that. But for the majority of the people listening to the podcast, I think that's a pretty big one. Friends and family rounds are much lamented, but extremely important places. So let's start there. If you're going to take money from your friends and family, and this is, so I took money from friends and family on top of majority of my own capital for Coast. I did my best to talk all of them out of it. I showed them the business as honestly as I could. I showed them the potential for the business to grow and where we had gotten so far. And then the people who wanted to continue, I did my best to talk them out of it. I told them every inch of, you're going to lose your money. The chance startups like this who are at high risk have a 95% chance of failing. It, as a founder, as an entrepreneur, it'll make you feel a hell of a lot better knowing that people believe in you and they want to give you money, regardless of knowing you're probably going to fail. And failing in an entrepreneurial sense is not a, I yeah. hate the word.
It's no, not, I agree. It's a fall forward. Because of the experience.
If you work exactly. your ass off, it's a fall forward, right? Yes. Like there's lots of guys who burn through capital and just be dicks about it. And it's typically VC money. So I'm not even really going to address VC money, because anything we're talking about right now is never going to be within VC money. VCs, if for anyone who is listening, VCs typically invest in companies that
and
are
VCs is positive, a venture capitalist, by the way. Sorry, Dylan. VCs is venture capitalist. So this is a Series A round, Series B round, which is usually something like Facebook. So you have this big idea. It needs to really scale quickly. It's within a small little niche, but now it's growing. That's what a VC is. Sorry, Dylan, for cutting you off.
No, it's okay. It's good clarification. And so those guys are going to be looking for, you're over $1 million in revenue, pretty much is the most. That's like your Teletubbies, Sesame Street level benchmark is you're over $1 million in rev. That your cash flow positive is a big sign of valuation, and they value in many different ways. So there's this thing called EBITDA, which is earnings before interest, tax, depreciation, and amortization. In the tech world, they're going to give you a 4 or 5x on your revenue on EBITDA. You got to look at what you're earning before all those things I just mentioned, and then times it by 5. And that's probably what your company is valued. Now, if you don't have any revenue, that's pre-revenue is a way different situation. So you can raise money pre-revenue, but that comes down to how good of a pitcher you are, how good of a picture you can paint, or an image you can draw for that type of investor.
Sure.
VCs probably won't go for it if you're a first-time CEO, a first-time entrepreneur. If Mark Zuckerberg stepped down from Facebook and said, I'm done with Facebook, now I've started this new company, and he's done it for a year and it's created no revenue, I guarantee you he could raise $200 million.
Of course.
It's all about who you are at that point. You have to have the narrative, and then you have the advisors, and you have the board, and then you have yourself, and how well you can build that story is incredibly important. So being a good salesperson comes on top, which is why I've been fairly successful, is I'm a pretty good salesman.
It has something to do with talking your way out of. That's why I asked that question for most of the podcast.
Well, that's why I credit my mom sometimes more than my dad, even though he was the entrepreneur. But going back, there's a lot of sources of capital that aren't these traditional sources. So there's angels out there, right? There's angel meetings. Oh, sorry. What an angel investor is a person of high net value who invests on their own into individual companies they believe in. You can go to angellist.com is a great resource. You'll find lists of people who are literally angel investors. They don't join funds. They don't invest in funds. They invest in companies that they vet themselves. They typically take a board seat or they'll install someone they trust on the board. They're all over the world. They're as local as people who put in $20,000 once a year, and they're as global as people who invest billions. They're a massive resource, and that is straight up grinding. You need to meet them at networking events. In this world of COVID, when networking events are few and far between, services like lunchclub.ia or AI or IO, I can't remember what it is, but if you just type in Lunch Club in Google, you'll find it. It's a great service. It partners you with people in your locality or maybe globally, and you can choose between interests. So that's a great way to meet people. Meetup.com is a great way to meet people. And just being open to all sorts of walks of life, working your network hard. You'd be surprised how many people who are mentors or maybe owners of the businesses that you work for who have a little bit of money stored away for opportunities that they see as good investments. And you need to be open and honest about your company and ideas and how you think they'll be successful and how that person can benefit from that. And that's really, when I first started raising money, friends and family, because I started traditionally with VCs in the mining industry. We raised from institutional capital, some like PI Financial, Goldman Sachs, big investment banks. That's where I started raising money from. So I was very like methodical and scientific about it.
Yeah.
But when I started raising money from angels and friends and family, one of my mentors told me when I was feeling a bit trepidatious about asking them, and said, hey, listen, do you think you're going to be really successful? Do you believe in this? Do you think you're going to make a lot of money? And I said, yes to all three. And he said, why wouldn't you want your friends and family to share in that then? And I was like, hey, you know what? That's a really good insight on why.
And if you don't, you should probably not start the company.
Yeah, and that was the big thing. If you don't really believe in this, then why are you doing it? And I did really believe in it and was able to offer them. My first company offered some of my close friends and family made a lot of money. On my second company with Ghost, not so much, but that's the gamble. And that's, again, going back to that first thing I said, is I do my very best to talk my friends and family out of investing in me to ensure that they're eyes wide open. I don't want them to ever think that I've tried to scam them or make them feel pressured into investing. It's not who I am. It's not how I get people to invest in my businesses. It's I show value, I show success, and I show trust.
Mm-hmm. And those people that are looking for maybe additional funding, so maybe they've put in their friends and family and now all of a sudden they need funding but they don't want to give up equity, what are the options for them? From your experience?
In a non-COVID year, you could talk to, there's lots of accelerators, small loan, provision companies. If you're in the States or Canada, you have provincial or state funding. You have banks that will give you loans. A lot of people poo-poo debt financing, which I don't think is fair. Yes, if you take debt, you typically have to personally guarantee it, which means you're on the hook for it, which is why I always... No, this is a hard rule. No debt to finance operations ever. If you are a negative cash flow business, if you are in any way negative or non-positive growth, do not take debt to finance operations. You will end up having to pay that back. If you are a positive business and you have a very good opportunity, there's no such thing as a guaranteed opportunity, but a very good opportunity to grow, and you can't afford it through your own cash, that's the time to go to the bank and take a loan. And you take a big loan. They want to give you 50 grand, take 100. They want to give you 100, take 500. If you can scale an opportunity on cash, take as much cash from debt as you can fucking get.
And why is that? Like, I'm following your logic there, but why take way more?
Because if you can actually scale the business, I guarantee you'll run out of money before you've really scaled it. And if you can continue to scale it, and this is doing your due diligence, but if you can continue to scale it with cash injections, then you're going to need than as the much percentage, cash as you possibly can get.
Of course, because the alternative would be giving up equity. And obviously people that are in that position, you can give up a lot of equity too quickly.
Yeah. And if you're in a positive cash flow business and you're in a position to scale, you can take debt. Like, and right now debt is so cheap, right? Like you go to right now is actually really tough to get financing, debt financing, because a lot of the banks won't lend anymore. But if you're positive cash flow and you have a growth trajectory and you put that in a business model and you go pitch to the bank, I'm pretty sure you could probably still get it. But if you can get your debt at 3-4%, man, if you're selling on Shopify, or you're like, Shopify takes 2.7%. eBay takes 10% of your sales. Amazon is anywhere from 5-25% of your sales. If you put it into those kind of categories and you can take 4 or 5 or 6 or even 7% loan from an institutional bank, then you're getting a great return on capital, because all these other places take these massive percentages anyways. And so one thing a lot of people don't realize as well is that you take a few hundred thousand from a bank and you scale really well, and maybe you hit a slow period, or maybe you hit a point where maybe your receivables and your payables hit a little bit of an upside down, so you owe more than you're receiving for a month or something like that. Go to your bank and you can say, hey, here's the paperwork, here's the projections, things are going well, we just have a little bit of a cash injunction point. Let's give me a break for a month. Banks give it to people all the time. There's a reason when you watch CNN and you hear about these like massive institutions writing off $1 billion in debt. It's because they work the system, right? Banks have a fail rate and they work the system within that. And you just got to be on that, right? That's when you become, like I talked about with these contractors earlier, you go from an owner or from an artisan or an innovator to a business owner. That's the first step, is understanding that no price is static. All your relationships should be negotiated. And banks are, if you borrow enough from the bank, they shit themselves. When you say, hey, I can't really pay you back right now, let's work out a deal, because now that's their money. So there's a lot of things to know when it comes to debt financing. I would recommend any first-time entrepreneur, don't do it yourself. Mm-hmm. Find a mentor, find a partner, talk to
Is there any good literature or any good things that you have found throughout your navigation through the sea of all of this?
On debt financing? That's a great question. I'll have to look at some of my resources. Maybe we can offer them like in the show notes after. Yeah. I just can't think of anything off the top of my head on debt financing.
When we talk about taking that loan out, so I know that some companies will then put that, so the company will then have that money in the bank, then they invest some of that money and then use some of the interest to be able to repay the loan. Did you guys do any of that with Coast as you took capital out, or was it just emergency runway, or how did that work, or how do you know that other companies have done that in the past?
So I took money out for Coast on a debt to finance a marketing program and inventory purchasing for my previous tech company. We actually didn't have to take much debt, but we took a little bit of debt to finance some equipment purchasing. So again, that's if you're taking out debt to pay payroll or pay rent, it's a real bad spot. You don't want to be in that spot.
Yeah.
You're chasing the dragon at that point, right?
Yeah, of course. No, that's totally true. And how did you pay yourself? So a lot of entrepreneurs have a little bit of trouble with that. Since we're on the topic of money and financing, did you incorporate the company? Were you a sole proprietor? Did you start paying yourself a living salary right away? What did that look like for you?
So I always incorporate. I actually incorporate all my companies, and then I pay my private holding company, which then issues me a dividend. I do that for layers of protection.
Yes, of course.
I also do that for a bit of tax protection, although that loophole was closed a few years ago where you're still paying income tax. So it doesn't really matter.
Sorry, just for the listeners listening. So when he's mentioning incorporation, essentially functions as a new human. So just in its most simplistic terms possible, if I am Sean Pepper and I'm a sole proprietor, I am still Sean Pepper. If I am now incorporated in my company, that company now owns everything and all the business operations, i.e. if I go bankrupt or the company goes bankrupt, I still have my house and my protection, and I can pay myself as an employee of the company.
Exactly. But if you're planning on using a corporation like I do as a, you know, tax haven, then definitely go talk to a tax planner, because you're going to have your world rocked a little bit. But paying yourself is really, so you need to be honest with the company and with yourself. Whenever I started a company, I'm not really in that position anymore, but when I used to,
yeah,
I would write down all my finances. So all my costs, and then, but not just your baseline, not like subsistence, but like how much to take my girlfriend out once per week on a date night to a decent restaurant. Not, you know, like,
yeah,
spend
for
sure. $50 to $100 sort of thing. And then, you know, how much to go on, have one, you know, weekend vacation, whether it's like to a ski hill per quarter, something like that. Nothing over the top, but enough to have that break. I built that into my wage. And when you live on that, like, you're paying yourself almost nothing, but it's enough if you stick to your budget that you are not in need of money. I've been in the position where I've been living off credit cards because I'm not paying myself anything. I can tell you right now, it doesn't provide any benefit to the company, and it doesn't provide any benefit to you, because, and it really comes back, is like, I had my first company, I was living off credit cards. We became very successful. We raised a lot of money. We started making a lot of money. And because of that, and I was a lot younger, I was like almost 10 years younger than I am now. I had a very, you know, quite a high amount of entitlement towards that money that we raised, because right. I lived so Spartan for so long that I was like, okay, we raised, you know, $1 million. I'm going to make $200,000 a year.
Right.
And you pay yourself that absurd amount of money. You pay your debts off, you know, your credit card, but then you're like, man, I'm making $200,000 a year, and that's, I'm burning a lot of money. And then you start cutting it down. It's just, mm-hmm. It's this kind of peaks and valleys system that I think is very pervasive within entrepreneurs. It's like, I'm going to pay myself as much as I can for the short time I can get it, rather than building it in and being like, you know, I'm going to pay myself a good living wage, good strong wage. And then when that, and stick with that and have a lot longer of a runway than I currently do.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's tricky for a lot of people, because if you're paying yourself the living wage, then you also have to get the finances and financing in order to pay yourself that wage. And I think starting from that point is probably a better situation than starting the other way around, because you can, like you said, you can get into a situation where you're not able to pay your rent, and you cannot operate as a business operator. The shift between being an artisan to a business operator, you can't be a business operator and make those type of decisions and the systematic thinking with no sleep and being stressed about paying your bills. It's not possible.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Can I give two? Here's one real like nugget for anyone who needs to raise money.
Yes, that's what I'm trying to tease out of you right now. So as many nuggets as possible.
Okay, never raise money. Never try to raise money in August. Never try to raise money in December. Your best raising times are the spring and the fall. In August, all the rich people are on vacation with the kids. In the fall, all the kids are back at school and they're around. And that's the same thing with January, and the early spring is everyone is gone for Christmas and everyone's gone for August.
That makes sense. That's a very, very common sense thing, but probably, yeah, you have to live to know it.
The other one is, if you're going to build a pitch deck, follow Guy Kawasaki's
pitch deck
methodology, 30-20-10, 10 slides, Sequoia Capital. Stick to a script, but also don't memorize it.
Yeah, don't be robotic.
Yeah, know your shit. But if someone interrupts you in the middle of your pitch, which they will, listen, active listening, engage with that person. Always have a ask. I can't not tell you how many pitch like sessions I've been to with 20 guys pitching, and like half of them didn't have asks. Like, they literally would pitch and they would not ask for money. Like, you are there to ask for money. So have I need $200,000 for
5% or whatever it
is. But not just for 5%. Like, but, and this is what we're going to do. So have a use of proceeds or a UOP, Google that, understand what that is, understand how you're going to spend that money, because nobody will give you money if you're like, I need 500 grand. What for? I need it for growing my company. No, what do you need it for? People who are rich do not become rich by being stupid with their money. There is the billionaire Instagram models of the world who just are rich and don't know what the fuck to do with their money. But the majority of your angels are savvy business people who are better at business than you, and they will take a chance on you if you're honest and hardworking.
For sure. Those all great, really great points. That gave me the time and space to think about the next question. How do you create systems in your life in order for your life to be easier and automate decisions?
That's a great question. I think for me, when it comes to systems building for personal, I'm actually not a, I'm not one of those type of people who's here's my routine.
Yeah. Yeah.
I do have, so every morning I walk my dog on the mountain. That's how I start my day. And I protect that point extremely hard. So if someone's like, hey, can we have an early call? Or hey, can, no, I just don't do it.
Yeah.
That forest walk, which like the Japanese, I can't remember the Japanese word, but they call it forest bathing.
Yeah.
So I know my dog has been trained. I know he's been exercised. And I just really covet that time with my dog because I love dogs so much. And sometimes Steph, my fiance, comes with me, but not always, maybe once a week or something like that. That's very important to me. But I also block my work day up. So I kind of pre-identify my tasks that I need to get done that day.
And how do you do that? Sorry, can you be specific?
Yeah, so I if I'm starting a new project with a business or a client or whatever it is, I make like essentially what is a Gantt chart.
Yeah,
that is just Google.
Yeah, I do. I know what it is, but just for listeners, essentially it's like a process chart of when things are starting and when they're going to finish with a client, or it comes from the world of engineering and where you have a bunch of different people that have to work on a project at one time. And therefore you need to know when certain people are going to be taking over the project or starting to work on it so that everybody can get a timeline for when it's going to be finished.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's a very good explanation. So I break my Gantt chart down into hours, and then I give myself hour blocks. And so I'll identify a task. I'll be like, this is a 2-hour task. This is a 1-hour task. This is a 4-hour task. And I break my day into 3 blocks. So I actually don't break my morning into a block. My morning is my morning. And then I have morning work, afternoon work, and then I have my evening. And my evening can either be leisure or work. It depends on the need. But morning and afternoon is work. And so I have 4 hours in the morning and 4 hours in the afternoon. So I have 4 blocks in the morning, 4 blocks in the evening or the afternoon. And so if I have 1 4-hour task and then, you know, 2 1-hour tasks and 1 2-hour task, that's it. That's the day. Mm-hmm. I will not try to force more into my day.
I agree with that.
Because you'll never do it. I can't remember who someone said this on some podcast I listened to a while back, was like, I always overestimate what I can do in a day, but I always underestimate what I can do in like a quarter or a year. So I take that very seriously now and say, maybe I'm only going to get one thing done today, but then that one thing is done. And then I follow my like more subjective thing that I follow very closely is the principle of swallowing the frog.
Brian Tracy, famous, for those people that are listening.
Yeah, very famous principle is that the way it works is if you had to eat a frog, would you chop it up into little beads and suffer through it? Or would you just grab that frog and shove it down your mouth and swallow it as fast as you could? So wake up. Do what you need to do for your morning routine if you have one. The idea of having a cold shower first thing as you walk out of bed to me is absolutely abhorrent. It's like, how would I ruin my day and make my day start on a really shitty footing and have a fucking cold shower?
Yeah.
I like cool showers. I always have because I'm like Pepper here. I've played lacrosse and hockey my whole life. Yeah. So usually the dressing room you're in, you can't get very hot water. So I like cool showers, but a cold shower, nonsense. But yeah, and then you sit down at your desk or you stand at your desk or whatever you do for your work, you do the shittiest, worst task that you don't want to do. You do that as hard as you can first, and then your day's easy.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree with that. It's usually the thing that you know that you need to do.
Absolutely.
It's that it needs to be done. You don't want to do it. It's been, and it's just been, the thing that I love about that method is it's usually the thing that causes a lot of mental RAM. So it's the thing that you're constantly thinking about anyways. And if you don't do it, you're still going to be thinking about it when you do the next thing. It's just, do you use any Pomodoro timers or like anything like that? Do you have a way of, so for me, I do pretty much the same actually as you. In that I create these chunks, a little bit different in that when I start the day, I identify how long the things are going to take. And then I chunk them a little bit differently because I have a family. So how that fits into our family day, but similar in that, like, I'm going to get an hour here, an hour there or wherever. But then I also, one step further, to use a Pomodoro timer, which is a 20 minute timer. And then I say in this 20 minutes, this is what I'm going to do. Cause I found when I try to chunk something that's a 4 hour project, I can get distracted. And then this is just me. I'm a distracted person, but I can go, oh, like maybe let's say I'm working on a marketing campaign. Oh, the design of this. And I can spend so much time on a design of something without actually like pulling my head up and being like, you just need to move forward on this is a 20 minute task. You need to move forward. Or this is 3 20 minute tasks, but just that time to 5 minutes to get my head up and being like, am I doing what I need to be doing here? Or am I getting distracted? Has been extremely helpful for me, and it might be helpful for listeners. I'm not saying that everybody should do it, but just something to add on there.
Yeah, I think that's you nailed it, right? Like, you got to figure out what works for you. I don't do the Pomodoro technique because I can't go from zero to work. It takes me a good 15 minutes to really get my zone in. So if I'm on like a 20 or 30 minute timer, like a quarter or half a quarter of my time is just getting like into that zone. But once I'm in the zone, like I can work for 6 hours straight.
Yeah.
My 4 hours, like my 4 hour blocks are always in the morning. I never 4 hour block in the afternoon. It's always short block stuff.
Yeah.
And that's because in the morning I sit down and I cut out all the distractions. And that's another thing. Like, I typically work from home, but lately I've been working at an office with my new job.
What is your new job? Just out of curiosity for those people listening.
I took a what I would call a break job. So I worked with two general contractors this year as my clients to help them scale their businesses, and actually facilitated a merger between the two companies. And they are doing so well, scaling so fast, that they were hiring a general manager. And I was actually helping them hire a general manager. And realized I enjoyed their company so much, and the speed of the growth, the type of work, the working atmosphere environment, that I took a fairly ridiculous pay cut to go be their general manager. And I'm loving it. Like, I absolutely am just loving it. It's not something that I'll do forever, but it's something I'm going to do for at least 6 months, maybe longer, depending on the growth and trajectory of the company and where I can get it. But it's back in the office, and I'm not really built to be a consultant.
Yeah.
I'm a real team player. Like I said before, yeah. I'm a team sports guy. I love teams. I love groups of people. I don't like being by myself. So sitting in a basement in my house for the last 9 months as a consultant was not the most fun I've ever had. And
of course,
at the end of the day, for me, work is a combination of value or finances or capital or payment or money or whatever you want to call it, and fun.
Totally.
I don't want to do a job I hate. I've never had a job I hate ever. Mm-hmm. Even I started working when I was 12 as a food stocker in a grocery store, and I loved learning about all the fruits and vegetables. And then I was a carpenter, and then I worked in mining. I did sales jobs throughout university for Molson and for Monster Energy Drink. I've never had a job I didn't like. Probably because as soon as I didn't like it, I just quit. But
yeah.
I can't imagine that idea of, oh man, I'm just going to sit here and do this for 10 years or 15 years. And I think it's always, if you're enthusiastic and if you're driven and ambitious, there's always a role for something you want to do.
I completely agree with that. In fact, that's probably one of my frustration in the whole teaching field. I always felt like it's one of many industries where people get brought to certain positions of power based on time or experience, but not necessarily based on the skill set for the role. I want to be mindful of time. I'm going to ask you the question that I ask everybody on the podcast. How would you like people's lives to change as a result of your interactions at work, at home, or online?
Wow, that's a great question, actually.
Thank you. I spent a long time thinking about it.
Well, that's fantastic. I think the way I approach work, and I just alluded to it, and I understand that not everyone's in this position, but is being like, what's your impact? So many people go to work as zombies. And I think it's so much more interesting if everyone doesn't. Like, if you take real interest, even in a job you hate, taking real interest and really, and bringing your passions. Like, I can't help tell you, I've had about 9 clients in the last, about a year that I've empowered people at those jobs to bring like sustainability or diversity work or quality work to the workplace because it's something they're passionate about. And I think for whatever reason, as Westerners, we're really like shy about bringing ideas forward. Because we think people think they're stupid or whatever. And I got to tell you, so many people are out there looking for great ideas that if you just are passionate and pitch someone, like, you're going to have ears listening to you. So just really, I'm big on sustainability and environmentalism, but it doesn't mean everyone else needs to be or has to be or is. So whatever, if you have a cause or something, as long as it's not something like, if you're a Nazi, maybe shut the fuck up, don't say anything, but everything else, get after it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great advice. Pursue your passions and find the tribe that will then support you to do that.
Yep, for sure.
Awesome. Thank you very much for being on the podcast. And where can people find you if they want to work with you? We just talked a little bit about consulting. If they're starting a business and they want to reach out and find more information.
You can email Dylan at guidedbrands.com. Okay. It's a good place to start. I unfortunately have been too lazy to launch a website just because most of my business is referral, but maybe I'll do that.
I can help you with it. No problem.
That'd be dope.
All right, buddy. Take care, and thanks again for taking the time. We really appreciate it, and I think you provided a lot of value to the audience today, so we really appreciate that.
Absolutely, man. It was a lot of fun.
Hello, everyone. Sean again. I just wanted to take this time and say thank you. You have helped this podcast reach growth-minded humans on 5 continents, 26 countries, and 128 cities around the world. Without people like you listening and sharing, this would not be possible. If you have enjoyed this episode, would you consider leaving me a review on Apple Podcasts? These reviews really help me to reach more listeners and more guests. Life in today's world can be hectic. I hope you stay healthy, play more, work hard, love deeply, and as always, be bold, be kind, be you, be human. See you next week.